This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 7th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, as the BP oil disaster spreads, the wildlife death toll mounts and officials struggle to save oiled birds and sea turtles.
They can be worked on and be released back into the wild and can be productive again.
The federal government challenges Arizona's anti-immigrant law in court. And we'll go to Venezuela, where residents are changing their daily routines in response to increasing crime. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Indian Army has been dispatched to Indian-administered Kashmir's main town, Srinagar, to help implement a curfew and contain recent protests. Journalists, once exempt from the curfew, are now feeling the crunch as well. For FSRN, Shahnawaz Khan has more from Kashmir.
A new round of protesters erupted Tuesday over a boy's death, allegedly at police hands. Authorities responded with a strict curfew in Srinagar and other major towns in Indian-administered Kashmir. The Indian Army was called in Tuesday night to assist the police and paramilitary. Some protesters and minor clashes with police continued today, according to local media reports. In addition, authorities have revoked the passes that allowed journalists to be out after curfew, making it unlikely that several daily newspapers will hit the stands tomorrow. The last time the Srinagar-based newspapers failed to publish was in 2008, when the state enforced a prolonged curfew to crack down on peaceful, pro-independence demonstrations in the region. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
A Supreme Court ruling today changed the rules for gays and lesbians seeking asylum in the UK. From London, FSRN's Naomi Fowler reports.
In at least 80 countries around the world, homosexuality is illegal, and in six of them, gay and lesbian people can receive a death penalty. Equality and human rights campaigners have long accused Britain's asylum system of institutional homophobia. While all asylum claimants face an uphill battle, gay refugee claims face a higher rate of rejection, even when the person has presented evidence of imprisonment, rape and torture. UK lesbian and gay immigration group statistics show that between 2005 to 2009, over 98% of gay asylum claims were refused at the initial stage. That compares to the general refusal rate of 76%. Today, two gay asylum seekers successfully appealed their cases. The men from Iran and Cameroon had been told by British authorities they could avoid persecution by keeping their sexuality secret or by being discreet. But the Supreme Court judges ruled unanimously that that contravened the UN Convention on the Status of Refugees. Campaigners hope the policy change will allow more gay and lesbian people whose lives are endangered in their home countries to gain asylum. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
In other LGBT news, the Republican governor of Hawaii, Linda Lingle, has vetoed legislation that would have provided civil unions to same-sex couples. Lingle said the issue should be referred to voters. The ACLU told local media that it intends to file suit to ensure equal rights for gay and lesbian citizens. A new EPA proposal would cut the amount of pollution that crosses state borders in the eastern part of the country. Because of air currents, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides often move across state lines and concentrate, adding to state air pollution loads and making it more difficult for many to meet Clean Air Act standards. The pollution reduction proposed by the EPA could lessen how much downwind states have to pay to deal with pollution created by their neighbors. Today, the Justice Department unsealed the indictment against a Colorado man who allegedly plotted an attack on the New York subway. Authorities apprehended Najibullah Zazi for allegedly taking part in the Al-Qaeda-led plan. The indictment also names four others, three of whom were leaders of the terrorist organization's external operations program and accused of organizing the unrealized attack. One of the men, Adnan El-Shukri Jumha, has been wanted by the FBI for several years. The Justice Department says El-Shukri Jumha was also involved in a bombing plot in the UK broken up by British security last year. Each of the men faces life in prison if convicted. Women in Nairobi's poorest areas live under the constant threat of sexual violence. According to a human rights report released today, the threat often leaves these Kenyan women and girls too scared to access basic sanitation facilities. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Kenya.
The new Amnesty International report entitled Insecurity and Indignity, Women's Experiences in the Slums of Nairobi, Kenya, details how the government has failed to incorporate the slums in urban plans and budgets. This has left residents with poor access to sanitation and other services. Amnesty International's East Africa researcher Godfrey Odongo says lack of adequate bathroom facilities make women vulnerable to rape.
The report, Insecurity and Indignity, Women's Experience, how women are disproportionately affected by the lack of toilets and the lack of bathroom, and that puts them in an indignity and in an insecure situation.
Odongo says the women consequently become prisoners of their own homes and are forced to use plastic bags as toilets. The human rights group says only about a quarter of the slum residents have in-home access to a bathroom. The lack of police in these areas compounds the problem. Amnesty International says the government needs to improve security and force landlords to construct more toilets and bathrooms in the slums. Mohammed Yusuf, FSRN, Nairobi.
And finally, anti-whaling activist and New Zealand resident Peter Bethune has been issued a suspended sentence by a Japanese court after being arrested for boarding a whaling ship last year. The Sea Shepherd activist was on board the 80 Gill when it was rammed and destroyed, in the words of the group, by a Japanese whaling vessel. Bethune says he boarded the ship in an effort to make a citizen's arrest of the captain. The Japanese court suspended Bethune's 2-year sentence and will deport him to New Zealand. Japan is one of 3 countries that continues to hunt whales. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. The federal government is pushing to reinstate a 6-month ban on deepwater oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. The Obama administration's Department of the Interior submitted a court filing Tuesday in Louisiana, arguing that the ban is necessary to prevent another disaster. The ban was first put into effect in May, but came under criticism from businesses and politicians in the Gulf region who said it would hurt the economy. A judge agreed with a court challenge to the ban and on June 22nd issued an order to block the moratorium, allowing deepwater drilling to continue pending appeals. Meanwhile, the toll on wildlife in the region grows. Ken Rice is the Wildlife Branch Director for Sector Mobile Incident Unified Command. On a teleconference with reporters today, he spoke about the challenges in monitoring the effect on wildlife in the region.
The issues that we have, of course, is getting proper information when the public calls in, finding good locations and getting these birds captured and back to the rehab facility so that they can be worked on and be released back into the wild and can be productive again.
Rice said other marine life, such as dolphins and turtles, have also been affected by the spill and that hundreds of birds have been captured with evidence of oil contamination since the beginning of the spill.
The birds that have been impacted the most have been birds that have direct contact with the water, of course. A lot of these are called northern gannets. They're seabirds that spend the entire time of their life on the open seas other than when they nest. We've also had quite a few brown pelicans, a few shore birds. We've had a few terns, some of the pie-billed grebes.
Rice also said that many animals were probably going undetected despite efforts to find and rescue them. According to government figures, an estimated 1,400 birds, 450 sea turtles, and 50 mammals have died in the area impacted by the BP oil disaster. Officials warn that not all deaths are necessarily connected to the oil spill, and final determination of the deaths is pending. In other Gulf news, more than 27,000 abandoned oil and gas wells remain in the Gulf of Mexico waters, according to an investigation by the Associated Press, and oil companies and the government are failing to check the wells for potentially dangerous leaks. Regulations require oil companies to submit plans to reuse or permanently seal wells within a year, but the AP investigation found that the rule is routinely circumvented and that there are more than 1,000 wells that have remained unfinished for more than a decade. The BP well that led to the current disaster in the Gulf was in the process of being sealed for temporary abandonment when it exploded on April 20th. On Wednesday, President Obama announced the recess appointment of the new head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. The appointment of Dr. Donald Berwick bypasses Senate confirmation. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell accused the administration of sneaking Berwick through without public scrutiny, but the administration said Republicans are opposing Berwick's nomination to score political points. Michael Lawson has more from Washington.
Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution grants the President the right to make temporary appointments while the Senate is in recess, but it can be a politically risky move. As a senator, Obama opposed President Bush's use of recess power to appoint John Bolton as ambassador to the UN in 2005. Republicans have opposed Berwick's nomination from the beginning, calling him a proponent of rationing. But supporters say he'll play a role in the long-term success of healthcare reform. Healthcare researcher Igor Volsky is with the group Center for American Progress.
The idea that he was going to have some kind of open debate where we could really as a country talk about quality and what role quality measures should play, what role comparative effectiveness research should play in reform is really inaccurate. This was going to be a bloodbath. That's what they were planning to do, to delay implementation, to kind of score points in terms of the midterm election.
Dr. Berwick co-founded the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in 1991 and is considered a leader in improving the healthcare system by looking at quality of care, a major component of healthcare reform. The administration stressed in its announcement of the appointment that Berwick would be responsible for implementation of many provisions of the healthcare legislation that have a January 1st deadline. He is constitutionally bound to serve only until late 2011 unless he is confirmed by the Senate before then. Volsky says Berwick will still have to build bridges with Republicans and show results to be ultimately confirmed. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
An annual conference bringing together border state governors from the United States and Mexico has been canceled, a casualty of Arizona's controversial new immigration law. All six Mexican governors declared that they would boycott the conference, which was to be held in Phoenix and chaired by Governor Jan Brewer, who signed the law. Brewer responded by canceling the conference, which New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson says she has no right to do. As the nation's only Latino governor, Richardson says he's trying to salvage the conference by finding another venue for it. The border governors aren't the only ones taking action in response to Arizona's immigration law. The Justice Department filed a lawsuit Tuesday challenging the law on constitutional grounds. Tanya Snyder has more.
Agustina Flores's family moved to Phoenix from Jalisco, Mexico, more than 20 years ago. Like many Latino families, hers is a mixture of documented and undocumented members. She says the new immigration law in Arizona puts them all at risk.
You know, my family is still waiting for a reform, something that would help them further their process. And my sister, simply because, you know, she's in the car with me and maybe I parked in the wrong spot or something, because it could be something so simple. And now, you know, she can be taken away from her four-month-old son.
The Arizona law stops short of allowing police to stop someone just for looking Latino or having an accent. But as Flores says, the smallest thing can be the pretext for a police stop, and that opens the door to questioning about immigration status. A broken taillight or failure to mow your lawn could potentially result in deportation. It's a little like 287G, the program that allows local police officers to enforce federal immigration laws. But that program is supposed to have federal oversight, though that oversight has reportedly been lacking in many cases. And 287G operates in support of federal law. It doesn't create its own law. President Obama has repeatedly condemned Arizona's new immigration law. He mentioned it in a speech about immigration last week ahead of the Justice Department's lawsuit.
As other states and localities go their own ways, we face the prospect that different rules for immigration will apply in different parts of the country. A patchwork of local immigration rules where we all know one clear national standard is needed.
But that's just the problem. At a national level, politicians have been arguing about immigration policy for years, but not accomplishing much.
They really set themselves up.
Shuya Ono works with the Reform Immigration for America campaign.
Talking about federal responsibility, well, let's talk about that. I mean, the federal government has a responsibility to step up and get to work and pass immigration reform.
The Justice Department says that despite federal inaction, Arizona can't create its own solution to the problem of illegal immigration. The lawsuit doesn't challenge the law on the basis that it's discriminatory, though it does mention that danger. It simply says that immigration policy is for the federal government to decide, not the states. Shuya Ono says it's a little disappointing that the Justice Department argues with this technicality instead of standing up against racism.
However, I can understand why they chose the arguments they chose. Is without the law being in effect, without proof of racial profiling, I understand they can't get ahead of the game and claim that this will happen. I think once it does happen, then there's a whole other set of enforcement measures that I think we can all take.
Governor Jan Brewer issued a statement defending the law, saying it's both reasonable and constitutional. And she says it's ironic for the administration to fault Arizona for creating a patchwork of local immigration enforcement, since the administration doesn't object to local jurisdictions making sanctuary statutes, which directly violate federal immigration law. The Justice Department is asking for an injunction stopping Arizona's law from going into effect July 29th, arguing that the law's operation will cause irreparable harm. Arizona's law is facing several other legal challenges from Latino organizations, civil liberties groups, labor unions, and the State Chamber of Commerce. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
With the spread of online media, finding out what happened today is only a click away. But finding media that can provide understanding and perspective about the news is far more rare. Since 2000, Free Speech Radio News has aired on-the-ground reports from all over the U.S. and the world, and we have connected the dots to show the global connections in the news. Whether we're explaining policy maneuvering in Washington or army maneuvering in Pakistan, FSRN makes the connections that help you be a citizen of the world. Your support of FSRN goes a long way to help keep this in-depth news coverage coming. Visit FSRN.org to find out how you can help. I'm Dorian Marina, and you're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Stay with us. The federal government has charged U.S. Army Specialist Bradley Manning with multiple criminal counts related to the alleged release of a military video to the website WikiLeaks earlier this year. The video shows an Army helicopter firing on civilians in Baghdad. The attack killed several people, including two Reuters reporters. This brings up the issue of what kind of penalties and protections are in place for government whistleblowers. To discuss this, we're joined by Jesselyn Radak, Homeland Security and Human Rights Director at the Government Accountability Project. That's a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Manning is now detained in Kuwait. What are the charges that he faces?
There are two charges which are under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The first encompasses four counts of violating Army regulations by transferring classified information, including the so-called collateral murder video, to a personal computer and adding unauthorized software to a classified computer system. And the second charge includes eight counts of violating federal laws governing the handling of classified information.
So what are the penalties that he faces if convicted?
Well, four of the counts carry each 2 years plus forfeiture of all pay and allowances. And then another four counts carry up to 10 years each and a $250,000 fine for each count. And then the final remaining four counts carry 1 to 5 years and up to $250,000 fine for each count. So looking at the totality of that, he would conceivably be spending the rest of his natural life incarcerated.
Well, this case brings up the issue of what protections are in place for government whistleblowers. What is the law for government personnel right now?
For government whistleblowers, it is lawful for a federal employee to disclose what he or she reasonably believes evidences fraud, waste, abuse, illegality, gross waste of funds, or gross misconduct. However, intelligence officials and military officials and national security whistleblowers are not protected by the Whistleblower Protection Act that most federal employees are covered by.
And I assume the reason for that is national security and sensitive classified documents or information being released to the public?
I think that's the ostensible reason that things should be properly vetted internally if there's a complaint. And I'm not sure if Manning complained internally or not, but certainly other national security whistleblowers who are currently in the news complained vocally and multiple times internally to no effect. So in theory, yes, it's to prevent unauthorized disclosure of classified information. But that begs the question of what happens when illegal conduct is classified.
Right. So, what if military personnel or personnel in the intelligence community witnesses something that they consider illegal or immoral, as Manning contests that he did? What avenues are available for making that information public?
What avenues are public? None, basically. I mean, there's not a way to make that public. There are military orders, to my understanding, that you should not obey an unlawful order. But in terms of what to do other than complaining to your superior, it doesn't go outside of the organization.
Well, in the case of Manning allegedly connected to this, the video collateral damage, it was widely viewed on media outlets. It shows military personnel firing on unarmed civilians from a helicopter above. There are some reports that there are more documents, even more videos to come out. And one of the results of criminal action like this could be to affect future whistleblowers. What is the effect of something like this moving forward?
You know, I think this has a very real chilling effect on whistleblowers. I mean, it sends a very strong, unambiguous message, and the administration has not been shy about saying that it's trying to send a message. And to the extent that it's trying to send a message, that's one thing, but that's about politics. It's not about justice. And it's a very chilling message that they're sending.
Jesselyn Radak is Homeland Security and Human Rights Director at the Government Accountability Project. She joined us to talk about charges against government whistleblower Bradley Manning filed this week. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Crime has become a rampant problem in Venezuela, where murders, robberies, and kidnappings are spreading through all sectors of society. Many citizens lack faith in the police and are now taking measures to protect themselves and their families. Rachel Jones reports.
It's Saturday evening in Caracas, and Antonio De Stefano is drinking coffee with a female friend at an upscale mall. The 59-year-old pilot says his choice of destination was an easy one, since gunmen blocked his car on a highway 5 years ago, taking him hostage and threatening to kill him. Shopping centers are one of the few places he feels safe.
They had me from 5 in the morning until 11:15 at night, going around in my car. The thieves had my credit cards and were taking cash out of the ATMs and buying things. They left me on the main avenue naked at 11:15 at night. Since then, I've been terrified to walk the streets. So we came here because we have no other place to go.
De Stefano says that he lost his Toyota Corolla and some $16,000 that day, but he feels lucky to have escaped with his life. Now, he makes an effort to deflect attention. He's bought a modest Chevrolet Aveo and has traded his Rolex in for a plastic watch. Crime is on the rise in Venezuela. President Hugo Chavez's government hasn't released official murder statistics since 2004, but non-governmental organizations say there are roughly 16,000 murders a year, one of the highest per capita rates on the continent. Sociologist Luis Cedeño of Paz Activa has been following criminal activity in Venezuela for the past decade. He says the failures of Venezuela's justice system, police forces, and other institutions mean that most murders aren't prosecuted.
In Venezuela, there's an epidemic of violence, an epidemic that has been growing little by little over the years. And every year, we see a rise in the number of homicides, a rise in general crime, a rise in kidnappings, a rise in fraud. The impunity is nearly absolute for all crimes, and the most serious crimes are very rarely punished. For example, the impunity in the case of homicides is nearly 97 or 98%. So this shows us that the justice system is really failing to fulfill its role of punishing criminals and those who violate the law.
President Chavez says he's working hard to fight crime and has unveiled a new national police force. But Venezuelans still lack confidence in the government's ability to protect them. Pollster Alfredo Keller says concerns about crime, along with problems such as inflation and water shortages, have dragged the president's approval ratings down to below 50%.
We've asked people what is the most serious problem in the zone where they live. 51% of the population says it's crime. You have to realize that the second biggest problem is water shortages, and that's only 16%. So you see the extent of the crime problem.
Venezuela's dramatic murder rates are largely confined to poor urban neighborhoods, where gunfights between gangs are common. Our Maureen Ortiz sells coffee near the subway station in Petare, one of Latin America's largest slums. She says she's seen a handful of people killed during the 16 years she's worked there, and that she fears for her four children.
I see how the streets are because I work in the streets, how the crime is, how they kill people. I'm afraid when my children are in the streets because you never know. I tell them, look, at 8 p.m. you have to be inside because you know how these neighborhoods are these days.
More recently, crimes such as kidnappings and robberies have spread beyond poor neighborhoods to engulf all sectors of the population. A Spanish restaurant in central Caracas called Casa Farruco has begun closing its doors 2 hours earlier. Manager Manuel De Ponte says that there are fewer clients, partly due to safety concerns. He says that incidents have been sporadic, but last year, some customers were mugged while leaving the restaurant.
The clients didn't come back for some months, and then later they returned, but not walking. They called a taxi and took a taxi from the door. People are afraid of the insecurity, and often people don't come because of the lack of a police presence. Of course, it affects us a lot because one makes a living from one's clients. The costs are the same, and if the clients don't come, we don't have any income.
Even when the police are present, many Venezuelans find it difficult to trust officers who could be themselves involved in criminal activity. Government officials have said that some 20% of violent crimes are committed by corrupt police. Having lost faith in the police and other institutions, citizens such as Rosa de Gomez don't even bother to file a report when they're robbed.
You know that if you go to the police headquarters saying you've been robbed, they fill out a form and sign it, and they don't do anything else. It's a waste of time.
Government officials have made sporadic allegations that murder rates are falling, but have only released incomplete statistics that fail to back their claims. Meanwhile, critics allege that the government is withholding the information because it fears a political backlash. The government may be taking the wrong approach. Some experts say that as long as such figures remain a mystery, Venezuelans will consider crime their number one concern. Rachel Jones, FSRN, Caracas.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.